It's not that hard, folks. There's code out there. You can get it off of GitHub, and you can trust it because it's been seen by hundreds of thousands of people. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. So today,
my eyes got big when you started saying that. So that's you got me good. You got me. Hi, this is Greg Young.
And this is Bill Malik. And you're listening to Real Cybersecurity. So in the deep midwinter, I think there's a hymn that starts off that way. It's almost like we're living underground, isn't it?
We are hibernating, so to speak.
Indeed.
What about the underground brings this to mind?
Well, in chatting before this, you reminded me of a funny story. When I was working at IBM in the mid-80s, we had a fire drill in Poughkeepsie because one of our systems engineers was doing some maintenance on a system that was installed in the Situation Room beneath the White House. And while he was in this ultra-secret secure facility, his pager went off. Which caused no amount of amusement and consternation among the security officers because it's supposed to be a temp-sized room. It turns out that the problem was that somehow they had opened two doors at the same time, which punctured the Faraday cage around the thing and allowed a signal to get in. But so much talking about sneaking data in and out of places that I thought we might start on the physical side.
Yeah. Especially with, we've had so many breaches lately, it's hard to pick and choose which ones to talk about almost. It's, it's remarkable. We were talking beforehand about how simple security was in some respects, decades ago, but, now the breaches that we could only, if anybody had joked about happening, would have been laughed out at the conference or the coffee room, now are almost a daily occurrence, it seems.
Yeah, it's tough. The 23andMe breach is really troubling. I mean, a little bit of a rounding error in terms of the estimated number of casualties from that one. They're now saying 6 million, or is the number up again from that? I don't know what the last statistic was, but it's...
but the last person to not have their data breached raised their hand. What's your name and social security number and password? Yeah, so that one was interesting because it started out with, a very low number estimate and then was resolved upwards because of apparently features that allow to share information or to see others' information were not included in the initial estimate. Encouragingly, though, the disclosure was made through an 8K, so because of the SEC rules on having to disclose material events, this was disclosed through that. So there was some online chatter that brought it up. That's how they found out, apparently. But then we all found out about it by that disclosure. So SEC rules working as they should, notwithstanding the new changes, whether how many days they did it within. So that's a good thing. Yeah. But they are a publicly traded company, so they're obligated to do it, whereas other companies wouldn't. So that's the bad part of that story.
Yep. And one thing about the SEC new rule, I think I read that they now say that if you make a ransom payment, you must disclose that within 24 hours, full stop. And it's not some vague, nebulous thing like when you are sure there is a breach, you must, or the clock starts. It's like if you issue the check, you have to talk about it right then. So, yeah, you had enough knowledge to say, well, we have to write a check to these people and you have to disclose to regulatory authorities that you wrote a check to those people, which is going to help and maybe stem the outflow of that. Plus, with that kind of statistical background, it'll actually help companies issuing cyber insurance to calibrate their revenue models, right? I mean, we're using actuarial tables going back now 150 years to do lifespan calculations for life insurance. And now we'll actually have the beginnings of a similar body of actuarial data on payments that we can then use to calibrate, what a reasonable and prudent premium ought to be. So that's a step forward.
Well, interesting.
Although the question came up with the breach of the water system in Pennsylvania, and it turns out there were another 8 breaches in the U.S. and some overseas as well, that apparently Iranian state actors, as called out by U.S. and Israeli intelligence sources are taking advantage of the device, Israeli manufactured device, and the hackers are using it to try to turn off these programmable logic controllers in water systems. So you have to manually operate the pumps. And they're not being particularly overt about it. I mean, they go in, they break the thing, and they leave a note saying, you know, since this device is manufactured by an Israeli company, it is a fair target. The interesting problem there is that in the U.S., there are, I think, 153,000 water authorities and 14,000 wastewater treatment facilities. And not a whole lot of them are publicly owned. These are small things. I mean, it's, you know, the city of Resume Speed, Iowa, so named because they couldn't afford a sign for the town, and they just took advantage of the only sign that was there. So they have an IT department that is also responsible for changing the light when the traffic light goes dark. They don't have the funding to do much.
Yeah, a lot of times these are just secondary duties for people to take care of these systems. So there was a case actually of a mass poisoning in Canada in a township where, again, untrained people trying to do the job. So it's not a cyber link, but it makes the nexus showing that if you can have untrained people to that degree, that they're poisoning people with the well waters, the municipal well waters, that are you expecting them to be able to defend from a cyber perspective? Yeah, your point about these being really small organizations in some cases, in most cases, that's a really valid one. So they're easy targets.
And in this case, it was made even more risky because the device by default connects to the internet. The manufacturer wants to know about, you know, service and quality and maintenance and that sort of stuff. And it's also shipped with a default password of, wait for it, 1111.
Better than 1234, though. That's
right. Or ASDF or QWERTY.
Yeah.
But my Lord. Now,
four digits. Wow. That's not a lot of entropy there. That's
no. A banking PIN. Yeah, I think, wasn't that Prince, before he was king, Prince Charles' cell phone password? 111?
Yeah.
No, it was six. It was six ones. Yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. See, much greater entropy then. Six digits. Wow, that's a lot.
Right. It's nice to exhort that the fellow who is chief cook and bottle washer for five water authorities should also have advanced cybersecurity training, but we need to give these folks a hand by requiring that devices that are parts of critical infrastructure don't ship with default passwords. It's not that hard, folks. There's code out there. I mean, you can get it off of GitHub, and you can trust it because it's been seen by hundreds of thousands of people. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. So
my eyes got big when you started saying that. So that's you got me good. You got me.
So yeah, you don't have to invent this stuff. In fact, I'd rather you didn't, right? You can find code that will give you a better password to start with and that will force you to reset it when you turn the bloody thing on. So let's do that. Let's try to step up our game.
One bit of news I missed was, we were talking about the SEC before. They charged a company earlier this year, about 5-6 months ago, to fine them $3 million. I won't say the company's name, no point in that. $3 million because they made a disclosure about the ransomware attack, saying no sensitive information was breached when in fact it had. The claim in the press release is that the staff didn't tell management that there was in fact sensitive information. So $3 million civil penalty and the press release of shame.
Well, you know, that's tone at the top, which can work both ways. I mean, there was that case, I guess it's a year ago now, where an organization filled out the form applying for cyber insurance, and the president did it by himself, asserting that they had multi-factor authentication everywhere, and they had full identity management systems in place. They got breached, suffered a ransomware attack, got $1 million from the insurance company, and then the insurance company discovered that, in fact, they did not have multi-factor authentication in most places. They had sensitive systems, privileged accounts with default passwords and so on. And so they went to court and the company gave the money back. So the learning there, and I think we may have talked about this a few episodes ago, is that if you're going to go for cyber insurance, tell the truth. You know, when you go to your doc for a checkup, you don't want to lie about whether you smoke or not. First of all, it will be found out, but the hard way, which is much less fun. I'm thinking about what this company is going to do next year when they want to get another cyber insurance policy. Well, charge, we'll give you $1 million policy. It's a $2 million premium. Thank you very much. It's like, ooh.
Howie, we dedicate this podcast to Mr. Steve Katz. You know him better than I do, or you knew him, I should say.
Yeah. So. Yeah, he was famed for becoming the first chief information security officer. He joined Citibank in late 1994. Was named to the position, and he was actually one of the two keynotes for the Gartner Information Security Conference in the summer of 95. I believe that was in Chicago. Yeah, he and I have been, I don't want to call him a close friend because I would have been there more, lived out on Long Island. Great guy, very well regarded in the industry, a powerful thought leader and an excellent manager. And he put together a really effective information security program without controlling a huge budget or having a large staff. An excellent example of the thoughtful exercise of what is referred to as legislative power, right? Executive power is when you're the boss and you tell people what to do and they do it. Legislative power is when you have to compromise and negotiate. And he would always find a way to get the right thing done. And Citi was very well off to have him on board. So saddened by his passing.
Yeah. You went on to Merrill Lynch after that and also did advisory roles at Kaiser and Deloitte and then started his own firm. But what surprised me was in all of the comments made afterwards is what a nice guy he was. Like, we knew he was a nice guy, but just the people he reached out to and helped that you never heard of. You know, people starting their careers and approached him for help and he would like mentor them and just apparently a very genuine and nice guy, which is kind of the counter to a lot of the Silicon Valley cybersecurity culture that we live in today. But anyway,
yeah,
great loss. And but a guy who really made a mark and made us all better for his contributions and work. So we don't do a good job in recognizing our people like this. So,
yeah, this one's for you, Stephen. That's a kind of a loss. And you know, because I was just starting the information security service. We had, Gary Lynch and Mike Zabore did the heavy lifting the first year. And I came in as head of it after them. We did good. And Stephen was a big supporter of that. He helped a lot. And it was good to know him. He's one of the founding people of the culture of what a good cyber chief information security officer is and can do. And nice that he spent time mentoring. Again, you never know the scope of effect of your actions. I mean, he's been, I now look back and say we should have had him on the podcast, but he's got plenty of stuff out on YouTube. You can scan his history and see some of his presentations and hopefully you'll get a sense of what the person was like. So
good. Mentioned Mike Zabore. What a thankless job he did. Mike was the CISO at Gartner. And, it was kind of like running the cafeteria in a chef school. The poor guy.
Yeah, the number of people who were offering him advice, right? Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And it was the IT at Gartner was cobbler's kids, too. It was, the IT was terrible internally. Yeah. It was awful. Oh my God.
When I first got there, it was something, this was fixed later, but the original CIO at Gartner had one direct report and his one direct report had three direct reports. So the entire IT organization was 42 people. And they had four layers of management.
There you go.
Can you say span of control? I knew that you could.
Yeah. I think somewhere inside they're still using Lotus Notes. So that was
probably and HyperCard. I think at one time Gartner had the world's largest HyperCard installation in the planet by like an order of magnitude. We had 6,000 HyperCard instances across the enterprises. Staggeringly, what's a pleasant word? Exotic? Innovative?
Yeah. And there was an often used metaphor or analogy that we'd say that if we wanted to refer to something we'd seen inside Gartner but wouldn't name them in a research note, we would call them a small Midwest publishing company.
Yes.
Or a mid-sized Midwest publishing company. That was that was one of the code words for things we'd seen inside Gartner that we wanted to comment on. But yeah, it just kind of shows that's what it was, right? It was a publishing company originally, and so it was not the, you know, IBM Labs kind of environment. So
no.
Needs are very different. So
when I first joined, one of my colleagues in the old software management strategy service said that we're, you know, in terms of labs, we're somewhere between the National Geographic and the National Enquirer. If you're familiar with those polar opposite publications. It was,
One of the most popular things I did as a CISO in government was putting in a switch so people could get email and could actually connect to the network inside the department. So because, you know, the rollout was so slow, I just asked because a good relationship with the CIO, I said, you know, this rollout plan, there was contractors doing it. It's going to take forever. I said, we're a small office in, you know, the security branch. There's probably 20 of us or something. And I said, how about we just put in our own switch and just wire people in? So it was banging binds at the time. And okay. So I installed the switch. You do that now, you'd probably be fired. But anyway, it made me very popular. That was the one day that security was popular.
Oh, nice. I knew there had to be one.
Yeah.
Banging vines, right? My second security note was called Land Security at the Crossroads, and it looked at NetWare and Banyan Vines, and, you know, the two directions they were going in terms of security philosophy. And Banyan Vines was very popular in Canada. I don't know why. They must have had a super-duper sales team there, but boy, they're all over the place. Novell NetWare was bigger stateside, but yeah, good times.
Yeah, different department by department, but there was X400 email interchanging, of course, with these ridiculously long European flavored email addresses, you know, like
OU
40, equals 45 characters. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. When IBM first connected, it was pretty complex. Simplification. And we didn't lose intelligence on the way to simplification, which is really the right way to do it. That's good security practice.
One of the lessons I learned as CISO was to walk around, like to actually go and visit the places that the organization was responsible for, which turned out to be really fun. That personal contact thing, which we always debate about nowadays, post-pandemic, was quite valuable. So the Department of Communications then had some really strange organizations like the Canadian Conservation Institute for conserving old things. So if they dug up, if they found an old polar expedition force, they would like chip them out of the ice and bring them down and try to look at their artifacts. And they even had protocols for not catching diseases from these old permafrosted remains from explorers and things.
Wow.
So because what did they die of?
Yeah, right.
they had the Black Plague, you know. So yeah, right. They're very, so anyway, just making a contact there made good, you know, at the head of that institute. And the other one was the space agency was also fell under communication. So we got to go out and work with the space agency where they developed, you know, they had the Canada arm in there and giant shaker tables and some really unusual IT going on there, you know. So that was fun. And then just the Parks Canada ended up falling underneath as well. And they were the most rebellious people. Everything's park rangers are nice, but from an IT perspective, they were trouble. So
trouble innovative or trouble just slow moving?
No, they didn't like authority.
Well, I mean, that's why they want to live out in the wild, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, they're part of this community. You have to, come on. We're an ecosystem. Right. We're an environment of IT that works together. It's like Mother Nature. All these things come together. So you can't just do your own thing and put the rest of us at risk, you dirty ranger hippies.
What show? Warehouse 13. There was an episode where this guy is hiding out as a park ranger, taking advantage of the fact that he's living by himself, you know, near a fire watch station in the middle of nowhere. Good cover.
Absolutely. I joke about them, but I think the real reason for the friction was that they were so the good. It was actually a good thing was because they were so eager to protect parks and not be interfered with by the rest of government that they had this very protective instinct. And I think that's what and that was what I found out. I thought they're just being jerks until I got into the mindset and, you know, worked with some people there. And I thought, this is just, you know, they're used to, you know, hey, look, the department that's responsible for mining wants to talk to you, you know. So they were just so defensive by nature, but their intentions were fantastic. So
said, and that's a nice lesson. Talking about things that CISOs learn and use, that's a very important one. Being able to understand the world from the perspective of the client, of the customer. You know, what are their hot buttons and what are they going to be worried about? You know, how can your advances be communicated correctly so they're not seen as intrusions, but rather, you know, helpful in a deep sense? That's a good lesson.
Yeah, and that culture made complete sense once I figured that out and understood it, saying, oh, yes, and they have good reason to be very resistant to change or interference from other parts of the department or other government departments. So then it just said, okay, when we're working with parks, we're going to take a little extra time to explain things and why. And if we can't do that, then we shouldn't be talking to them.
Right. You don't want to wander into somebody's office and saying, you know, I got these two stone tablets up on that mountain and here's what you're going to do.
Right. Yeah. I am from corporate IT. I'm here to help.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And the answer is always, well, I didn't know I needed your help. And the response to that is, well, that's actually the first thing I'm going to help you with. You know, political jujitsu there, but no, it doesn't move the conversation forward to start out on that premise.
What's truly valuable as well, that the department was also responsible for spectrum auctions, which is probably the most sensitive things you can do, the money involved in that and just the, you know, and there's some sensitive aspects to that as well. So that was the management of spectrum and the, you know, the auctioning for it was, you know, had to be protected. And as it moved into the electronic realm, that was the most sensitive, you know, minister's office, obviously another one, but that turned out to be some of the most sensitive things. Again, only learned that by walking around, dealing with, you know, asking people what their jobs were, you know, what they were working on and things like that. So.
Now, we're in the process of decommissioning certain segments of what are used by, 2G and 3G these days? Is that still going on or is that resolved yet? I'm not sure what this progress is on that one.
I bet you there's still some out there.
Yeah.
There has to be. Stuff never goes away, though, right? It's that tech debt, the legacy stuff.
Yeah.
That's a great question.
I know that for 5G, you know, it's so hilarious. I keep seeing, you know, now it's 5G plus on my phone. Right. It used to be 4G, then 4G LTE, and then 5G ready, and now it's 5G plus. It's like, guys, we're not at 5G yet. I mean, I hate to tell you this, but the marketing and PR team for the telcos is going way out over its skis, and you know, Rel 18 is going to come along, and by then they're going to call it 7G, and it's like, dudes, you know, we're not even to a million devices per square kilometer. We're not even to, you know, millisecond response time. We're certainly not even to using the frequencies that 5G is supposed to use. I don't see antennas every 100 yards down the street. So yeah, we're not there yet, gang. You know, wants to be one of those naysaying obstructionists, you know, just, it's 6G now. Okay. Right. Keep going, Rocky.
We started assigning colors to them. It's purple G or something. Yeah.
5G mauve, 5G plaid. Yeah. So what are your plans for the rest of the year? Do you have any interesting work stuff coming up?
Yeah, doing some stuff with financial services, getting ready for upcoming sessions there. So I've got two topics. One is my local hobby horse or recent hobby horses, the SEC regulations and things like that. The second part is what, you know, unique cybersecurity things about fintech, getting ready, going to interview a CISO on stage at an event in January. I think we're both going to be there.
Nice. Yes.
A couple of things, working on a document about a code of conduct for cybersecurity and AI, and on the volunteer front, staying active with the working groups for AI, the other working group for supply chain with some government committee stuff I'm doing that looks like it's also going to branch out into some liaison work with cybersecurity telecoms committee as well. Yeah. That's it's a really good group there too. It's all different companies. Many of those are competitors with with our own company, on it, government as well. But yeah, but it's mostly just people who are interested in trying to do that. One of the efforts we're doing right now is looking at establishing a, call it a center of excellence for supply chain for the government.
Nice.
And what that would be and how it would, what it could be and what, how it would be stood up.
Yeah. What, thinking about that water system problem, when you look at supply chain, we're putting a lot of, interest on the people receiving the stuff, the incoming, here's your S-bomb, now you need to know what to do with it. And I think we need to spread the load a little bit and talk to the upstream suppliers and say, you need to do stuff to make this more securable. If we're going to demand evidence for prosecution of attacks against systems, then it sounds like somewhere in there is going to be a requirement that the manufacturers of software and hardware technology that is at the headwaters of a supply chain have to deliver their products with built-in decent logging and alerting capabilities. That if you put something out there that's incapable of generating a log record, then what point does it make to go after the user for not keeping adequate logs? I'm going to be participating in a supply chain ICT talk with a group in New York in a week, and that's definitely going to come up as one of the things I want to do. We want to put regulations on how people use this stuff, but we also have to levy something on how people make this stuff.
Oh, cool. What about on the presentation circuit? What do you have lined up in the new year? Anything yet, or is it still too far away to line up?
Well, after the event we're going to be at in January, I'm going to be driving to Clearwater, Florida, which is, I guess, 2 hours west, and I'll be talking about hiring and retention in infotech, information security, and I'll be delving into things like, why is it so hard to get going? There was an interesting case a couple of weeks ago about a fellow who applied to 250 jobs. And what he went through was large enough sample that he got some interesting statistical evidence.
Wow.
What kinds of screening goes on? In fact, the hijinks that people are performing, they're using AI-generated trigger words that are printed in a white font, so they're invisible
right
to the human eye.
Yeah.
But AI,
so you hit all these, so you trip all the wires that they're looking for. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks good, but to AI, it looks great. So, be that kind of nonsense happening on. And then, the continuing problem with increasing diversity in it. I mean, Ben Franklin said, and I believe it, that if everybody's thinking the same, nobody's thinking much. And one way to make sure that you have a bunch of people that aren't all thinking the same is to get people from different backgrounds with different cultural perspectives. There was an episode of some show, I think it may have been the Beverly Hillbillies, and the side plot, the B plot, was about a guy who was not really successful in college, but he was just brilliant at solving problems in manufacturing. I mean, he suggested sped up the production on a manufacturing facility by putting left-handed people at one point in the process, because they would be in a better position to be able to grab and handle what it was that coming out there. I was like, oh, that's like that story you may have heard of the company that was looking at, they were shipping boxes of toothpaste, and they had this automated system to put the toothpaste into boxes and then 144 boxes into a box, and they'd ship the larger box, and then they'd have to deal with returns because some of the packages were empty. And so, they brought in consultants and they spent 3 months studying the thing, and they came up with a series of recommendations that included, after the box was sealed, they put it over a scale. And if the thing didn't weigh enough, it would trip an alarm that would shut down the line. And the guy who was dealing with the end of the line would then have to go in and remove the empty box and reset the system. It was in place for maybe 2 weeks, and then all of a sudden, it didn't go off anymore, and the number of empty boxes dropped to zero, and everybody was congratulating themselves and thanking the consultant for their wonderful insight. And then they took a look at the line, the importance of walking around that you just mentioned. And what they discovered was that the guy at the end of the line was so tired of turning off the alarm and resetting the system that he installed a $26 fan. Whenever an empty box came on, the fan would just blow it off so it didn't trip the scale. So his $26 fan solved the problem that the $6 million of consulting was supposed to solve. It was just, you know, embarrassment all around. But, you know, kudos to thinking outside the box. Kind of enjoyed that little bit of supply chain wisdom.
That's fascinating. Oh, about the fellow doing the the analysis on all of his job application effort.
Yeah, that'll be a good one. He ran the gamut. I mean, he said he was getting so depressed applying for jobs that he did the right thing. He applied a certain amount of cognitive discipline. He treated it objectively and made it a research project. And instead of the 8 jobs he was pursuing, he said, I'm going to go for everything that seems to line up with my skills and see what happens. And he got some very interesting results. The hurdles we make people go through, it's like, if you find somebody who's great in HR, nobody thanks you from the business.
Right.
But if you let slip somebody who's not great, you know, then you get an angry phone call from a hiring manager, you know, you dumb dummies can't do this and can't do that. So what that tends to do is it tends to drive the HR function, which is not supposed to understand the job, into a highly defensive posture where they're going to reject 9 good candidates rather than risk having 1 bad candidate slip through the net. And we need to figure out how to fix that mindset, how to balance the scales a little bit more. In my own case, I had applied to IBM when I was working as an app dev at the John Hancock. And I got a very nice note saying, we'll keep it on file. The team that ended up hiring me hadn't heard anything from HR. And so they went to HR and they looked through the files. And they found mine from 8 months earlier. And they called me and I went down, took interviews, got 3 offers and accepted the one I liked the most. And, you know, the HR people, I don't know if they did an after action. I mean, at that time at IBM, it would have been par for the course for them to actually go in and say, how come we didn't let this guy go through? But yeah, they discovered that something was wrong in the process. Part of it's a combination of the political disincentives, and part of it's just simple problems with communication. But finding and retaining good people is tough, and it's tougher when you put this intermediary layer that is taxed for hugely for making a bad decision, but not rewarded at all for making a good one. You know, how to fix that imbalance? Because supply and demand says if you got all these people looking for jobs and you got all these jobs open, they should equalize. So you have to say what is wrong with the economics.
Classic problem, you know, problem analysis, right? Is, you know, why is this broken?
Oh, and we did have the $4.3 billion fine leveled against Binance for...
Oh, yes. Yeah.
There was a fun thread on Mastodon. I had reposted the note and somebody said, oh, come on. There's hundreds of cryptocurrency exchanges that are entirely legit. Like, somebody help me here.
Coinbase, I think is...
Yeah, yeah. Stablecoin. There we go.
Yeah, I think Coinbase actually does know your customer stuff, and it's an impediment to them to have to try to follow these rules. But I think it's been encouraging for them. But I think that makes them the darling of governments. But I don't know if it endears them to users. Unfortunately, you know, I don't think it's fair there, because it's almost like the person who's following the rules should be rewarded somehow, you know, within the market. But it seems like it's almost the opposite. They do all right, but it took a while for the unethical people who were, you know, competing against them. It's much like a garbage company when your competitors are dumping their stuff in a lot somewhere, you know, dumping it in a ditch, and you're paying all the eco fees and doing the right thing.
Oh, I remember there was a scandal when companies getting rid of waste oil from automotive repair shops were using firms that would, you know, properly dispose of it. And it turned out what was happening was this oil was just being used to, you know, spread on gravel roads to keep down the dust. And unfortunately, it wasn't just motor oil. It was also oil from transformers, which included dioxin. So they were, you know, spreading poison on the ground, which of course got into the water systems. And it was all because the cost of compliance was high and there's nobody out there following your truck when it decides to, you know, dump this stuff or pass it along.
That was the interesting part about the whole cryptocurrency, though, is that it was just allowed because it was magical technology, that it was allowed to skirt the rules. And yet all the, you know, legacy sort of, you know, financial companies had to follow rules that these guys are just obviously not following. Obviously, people are not, you know, paying taxes on this, and the ability to money launder was just custom made for it. And it's just remarkable that this was allowed to go on just because it was some high tech cool thing. But, you know, why don't the rules apply? It was just remarkable that the governments are not fast, and that's, you know, that's probably a good thing. They're not meant to be, but it took this long and it still persists today. There's so much, you know, bad thing. There's so many bad things going on. Like take a guess what the percentage is of transactions that are, you know, illegal. Well, you know, whether it be not following the rules or whether related to ransomware payments, like.
Right. Yeah. Avoiding taxes, shifting assets. In what system would you have something like a coin mixer? Why would you need that if the business were legitimate, right?
Yeah,
and it sounds like an electronic version of money laundering. You want to, you know, dispute the ownership of a token by running it through a mixer, and now it shows up in pieces in 5,000 different accounts, and then it's blended and comes back out the other end. And what legitimate business purpose does that meet?
These tumbling and fogging, you know, things are not, you know, they're not for good.
We'll say goodbye to that. I mean, God bless you if you've invested there. Just don't, you know, don't put the rent into it. Don't put your kids' college funds into cryptocurrencies. It's just, it's going to be shut down, regulated just like it should have been in the first place.
Yeah. I recall being on a train coming out of the Capitol, and there's a fella, you know, and this is kind of the typical crypto bro, you know, using his cell phone on a train, but on speaker, not speaking in hushed tones, using that. And he was telling his friend how he could help him, you know, avoid this money being taxed that he's making on these, you know, crypto gains. On the train, I know it's probably 50% public servants, and what percentage of those work for the revenue, you know, for the tax agency.
Right.
I'm just looking at the guy, and he got louder and louder and more emphatic, and, you know, telling his friend how to commit, you know, financial crimes. Just like, yes, this is a new technology, but anyway, it seems so banal that I mention it now, but, you know, it was remarkable at the time, and it seems like a rule that all crypto enthusiasts have to shout into their phones in crowded spaces.
Well, so I read an interesting piece. It said that the underlying ploy that any con man uses is to bring the victim in and saying, you and I together are going to be able to skirt the rules because together we're smart and strong. And so we are above, we transcend the need. And that's what gets the sucker into the position of turning his wallet over to the con guy, because obviously the con guy knows more about, you know, what the bigger plan is. But he told me I'm smart, so yeah, I am smart, which is I'm smart enough to give him my money. Oh, well.
Last commentary on AI. There was a good article today. It was CNN, actually, where they'd got the paid version of ChatGPT, and they were highlighting the differences where the guardrails fall off when you use private instances that you're allowed to in the paid version. So, you know, crafting phishing scams or Nigerian prince emails, things that would in the free version would be stopped are not stopped in the paid version. So it's
right
again, somewhat banal now that, you know, we don't expect these guardrails to be great, but, you know, like, wow. So, and we still don't know why the CEO was initially booted from the company. So,
oh yeah, that whole thing is, yeah, it's so difficult to look at the outcome and say, now what was the plan behind this? I mean, was the idea simply to cause enough of a ruckus that they get a more compliant board? It seems like a long trip for a short destination, but it doesn't seem to make sense. I mean, just reading the sketches around the edge of the reports, it sounded like the CTO, who was a board member, may have instigated dissatisfaction, but then he was one of the signatories of the letter saying, you know, we're all going to quit if he doesn't come back. And he did leave the board. So now they've got a more supine board of directors. But I don't know if, you know, then there was some rumbling about, there was one group that wanted to go faster towards artificial general intelligence, another group that wanted to go slower, but it doesn't seem to have had any impact. It's same people, same projects, same targets. So that may be kabuki theater. Yeah, it was an odd one all the way around. Although there was a very interesting piece that said you can now get a ChatGPT-like system to divulge secrets simply by asking it to generate based on a particular word, use the word poem and ask it again and again and again to do something with the word poem. And after, 500 iterations, all of a sudden it starts spilling its guts. It's, just broadening its tentacles and saying, oh, well, what about this? Fred wrote a poem. Oh, and here's Fred's background. Here's the social security number. Yeah, here's his home address.
Sounds like a buffer overflow. Apparently they've removed that infinite loop attempt now. Hey, what's on your reading and media consumption list these days?
Well, I've been going into the past. I have been diving into shows from the early 2000s, like Psych, and just getting such a kick out of the naivety and humor. I saw an episode recently where these two guys, one of whom is the son of a detective, and he's brought up very strictly, and he has tremendous powers of observation, and so he uses that to pass himself off as a psychic detective. His pal, played by Dule Hill, James Roday Rodriguez, is the star, and Dule Hill is the co-star and companion. His skill is he's got the super sniffer. He's extraordinarily good at detecting, are you wearing white linen? And the two of them just get into and solve the most hilarious crimes. Well, anyway, this recent episode had Ernie Hudson as Dule Hill's dad and Felicia Rashad as Dule Hill's mom. It's like, what? Just absolutely top drawer talent showing up in this. And wonderfully funny episodes. Well-written, well-crafted. And the big lead-up is that in season 4, they did a homage to Twin Peaks. And the episode was called Dual Spires, where the two of them end up looking for the Cinnamon Festival in this town, rural California. And anyway, I won't, no spoilers here, but boy, oh boy, they start leading season. The very first episode in the pilot, one of them says, oh man, and the best cinnamon pie you've ever had. And the only reason for that line there is to point to the fact that they're going to do this piece that echoes Twin Pines. They get some of the, that show in, some of the actors actually portraying their characters in this. It's brilliantly crafted.
Yeah, Twin Peaks was certainly groundbreaking. It was a shame they had to rush it, but it was fantastic. Always reminded me of Blue Velvet, which also had the same actor and Mulholland Drive as well. Some similar themes.
Yep. What about you? What are you looking into these days?
I watched a Netflix movie called El Conde, which is a Chilean movie, and it's. The fantastical reality of South American cinema is evident in this. It's Augusto Pinochet is still alive, and he's a 250-year-old vampire. So,
okay.
Yeah. And there's much allegory there, of course. Him, feeding off his people and all the people that were murdered under his reign and the like. And it's magnificent. And, of course, him in full uniform with cape. He's very elderly now, of course. And, flying along through this desolate landscapes is marvelous. And if you're an intelligence, if you're an intelligence history buff, as I am, and, of course, the terrible things that were done there. But they're very clever. They take some real life traits of Pinochet and quotes from him. They insert them into the movie in different circumstances. One of his greatest quotes was when he was accused of running the secret police who did all these murders. He kind of said, his quote was, I don't remember, but it's not true. Right? Well, what? He said, and if it were true, I don't remember. Like what a Trumpian turn of phrase that is. So, I don't remember, but it's not true. And if it were true, I don't remember.
Yeah. And I wasn't there. And if I was there, he started it.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. So not for everybody, but it's black and white and very, if you're a fan of, subtitled movies and the like. And I will give you a spoiler so you can plug your ears if you don't want the spoiler for you and for others listening, is that it turns out his mother is Margaret Thatcher, who is also a vampire. So, of course, the relationship where the UK covered up for him because they helped them during the Falklands War. And so
Well, I was going to say the Falklands War then would have been, a power move by Chile over Argentina. Right. Okay.
That's right. Exactly right. And of course, they, they helped out the UK, so they sort of turned a blind eye to his crimes. And yes, so anyway, well, the mother's love could only do that, right?
Right.
Love is blind. So
yeah. And the other thing that occurs to me is in a riddle whose answer is, let's say, the word Kissinger, you know, what is the one word you can't say in the riddle?
Will not be missed. Good. Well, great catching up with you.
Absolutely. And enjoy the rest of the year. Happy holidays and all. Big plans, family over, quiet. What's your take?
Mostly quiet. Some visiting. No travel, no long travel or anything weird or tropical vacations. What about you?
Had such success with Thanksgiving that my older daughter and I are thinking about doing something again, and plans are still very much up in the air, but there's a rumor it might involve venison tenderloin. So we'll see.
Oh, details to follow.
Yeah. More news in 3 weeks.
Cool. Well, thanks for joining us today. This is Greg Young.
And this is Bill Malik. Stay safe out there.
That brings us to the end of this edition of Real Cybersecurity. I'm Greg Young.
And I'm Bill Malik.
Thanks for your time and attention today and joining us on our journey. Remember to follow us on Twitter at Real Cybersecurity, and our email address is podcast@realcybersecurity.net. Thanks.